Hi there, dolls, music lovers, and fashion enthusiasts. Welcome to Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s, the podcast that takes you on a groovy journey through the lives and legacies of the incredible women who shaped these iconic decades. We are your hosts, Emma
and Abby.
And together we'll explore the stories behind the music, the fashion, and the cultural revolution that defined an era.
Each episode will shine a spotlight on a remarkable woman, from rock and roll rebels to fashion icons, and dive into their impact on the world. We'll uncover the historical context, chat with experts, and celebrate the lasting influence of these trailblazing ladies. So, grab your bell bottoms and get ready to rock and roll as we uncover the untold stories of dolls who left their mark. Let's dive in.
So how have your travels been?
It rained for 10 days straight.
No.
I didn't do anything outside.
Oh no.
But otherwise, it was great.
How beautiful.
I did a little bit of thrifting. I found like a beautiful Mexican embroidery vintage top.
Oh, that sounds lovely.
I had Eggs Benedict, but with crab cakes instead of ham, which you don't like seafood, but I like seafood. So that was just, I was
sounds
all over
very
that.
Fancy.
It's like $12, not bad at all. And I physically cannot lift this to show you because it is 25 pounds, and me lifting 25 pounds is not happening today after the day I had yesterday. But at the antique mall, I found a vintage electric typewriter in full working order.
So cool. Oh, how rad.
And that is so cool. I use it for things as like a different writing exercise because
that is so cool. You need to get away from the screen sometimes.
Seriously, I get my screen time report every week and I'm horrified. Like, what do you mean I've spent 16 hours total in front of a screen today? That's what happens when you run your own series and you co-host a podcast and all of the other things that I do. And so the typewriter, I think, is going to be a different writing exercise, a little more automatic. I allow myself to make typos because there's no backspace key on that. I've seriously been wanting to find one of these for years, so I'm so excited. And the viewers cannot see this, but you can. Big Shelf is here, the new and improved Big Shelf. So I'm now to three rows of records behind me as God intended.
It's a nice shelf.
Never mind the stacks and stacks of records and books in my hallway right now because I did not reshelf everything yesterday. Physically could not.
I think it is so underrated how much work it is to lift a bunch of records. Like, it is so heavy. When we moved, I was like, we cannot put all the records in like two boxes. We need to split this because no one's going to be able to carry that up.
As I was taking all the records out of the temporary IKEA shelf, I said, like, why did I pick such a heavy hobby? Especially when I'm over here built like a stick bug.
Next life, you're going to choose something light and breezy.
Yeah, like photography. Just as expensive, but way lighter. So that was my holiday weekend here. It was not a holiday weekend for you, Emma. What did you get up to?
I was quite sick the last 2 weeks, so not that much. But on Sunday, this was so wild. There's like a thing about moving to the German countryside that is absolutely stunning to me. And it's the fact that, like, they put together the most insane parties and, like, gatherings.
Really?
So on Sunday, the, like, music department of our small town turned 100 years old. And boy, it was a party. You cannot imagine. They invited their, like, 60 closest music club friends. And they came from Romania, from there. They did a huge parade. 3 hours of music. It was insane. They, like, shut down the entire town, closed all the roads. Teddy was part of it with his kindergarten, which was, like, the cutest thing. I last minute put together a ladybug costume for him. It was so sweet. But I didn't realize that until the day that this took place, that, like, the route they were taking was 3 kilometers up a steep hill. And, like, it's one thing to walk we did, but imagine doing that while carrying, like, a heavy instrument, playing while walking up there was super hot. I was so impressed with them. And then up on the hill, as the typical German thing, there was like a huge tent and beer and bratwurst and like all the things you can get. But it was so, like, it was insane because there are only a couple thousand people living in our town. And there were like tens of thousand people there that weekend. Because it's like the only thing happening in the entire area. So everyone came along. It was a lot of fun, though.
That's actually really cool.
Yes, I was like, this is not... Like, German Volksmusik isn't quite my thing. It's very trombone-heavy, I want to say. Like, it's like a very brass-heavy type of music. And people were, like, carrying all these heavy instruments up the entire street. I was like, I was freaking out. Like, they always dress in funky uniforms, like classic Lederhosen or Dirndl, but then there are also the type of, like, you can't make this up. Like, a town close to us, they're quite known for, like, having an old mine. And so they were wearing, like, funky hats with like, feathers and everything. And they were dressed in that, like, heavy clothing. And then also playing their instruments, walking up the hill. And then they always had, like, someone who was holding a huge flag on, like, a stick, carrying that up the hill, too. I was like, man, this is quite the hobby to take on. Maybe I should have learned a brass instrument.
I feel like the cool girls in school were always like, I picked the saxophone to play. I'm going to pick the saxophone.
Yes.
Because usually all the girls in band, they end up playing the flute or the clarinet. There were, like, no girls in drumline. There were no girls playing the brass instruments. It's always cool to see.
Imagine just casually at a party pulling out your saxophone being like, yeah, let me play you some. That is so cool.
That's what God intended for me to do.
Maybe you should start playing.
Was like, saxophone party trick. Instead, I have a purple plastic kazoo, which...
That is fun, too. I actually, my mom asked me whether I wanted to learn the trumpet. And for some reason, I was like, no, I want to play guitar. And, like, not that I hate playing guitar, but, man, the trumpet is so cool. And I don't know anyone who plays it. And everyone plays a little guitar.
True.
So that would be quite cool now.
Except for me. I have no... My hands can't make that work.
But today we're going to talk about a band who knew how to play quite well, at least after a little bit of practice. There is a band that for a brief moment in the 70s seemed to take over the world. Five teenagers playing something between hard and glam rock and going by the name The Runaways. Their lead singer, a beautiful blonde, was on the cover of every major magazine as they took on the world by storm. She could have never imagined what was to come when that random man laid eyes on her in a teenage club. No one could have. But Sherry Curry, the blonde girl from the valley, would live a lifetime before even turning 18. A lifetime preserved in her book, Neon Angel, A Memoir of a Runaway, and in records, pictures, and videos that would still be played even 50 years later.
Sherry Curry, yes, that is her real given name, was born on November 30th, 1959 in Encino, California. She didn't come into the world alone. She has a twin sister, Marie. In Sherry's eyes, Marie was perfect, the prettier, smarter, and daintier twin. Marie seemed to go through life dancing, while Sherry often struggled to fit in. The Curry household was, in her words, about as Ozzie and Harriet as it comes, a reference to the classic radio and TV series The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet. Think Leave It to Beaver. Sherry had an older half-sister, Sandra, from her mother's previous marriage, and a younger brother named Donnie. Sherry's early childhood was idyllic, spending sun-soaked days in the San Fernando Valley and surfing at Paradise Cove in Malibu. She had a custom 8-foot blue and yellow gun board. Being from the land of ice and snow, I had to look that up. That is a kind of surfboard.
Me too.
Yeah, no oceans in Germany.
At least not where we live.
And by the age of 12, Sherry was waking up before dawn and heading to the beach alone. She was drawn to the ocean and the independence it gave her. A true California girl. At only 2 years old, Sherry and Marie were on an episode of the sitcom My Three Sons. They were supposed to sing Twinkle Twinkle Little Star, but they both froze during filming and their part was cut from the show. Aww. Several years later, the twins returned to TV as background dancers on the legendary American Bandstand. Sherry adored her father, who always called her Kitten. Quote, My dad was the most beautiful, handsome man I had ever known. Before he met my mother, he was a Marine paratrooper, a gunnery sergeant. He was heavily decorated for his service in some of the most treacherous Japanese campings of World War II. Don Curry was a slim, handsome man with a smooth, Dean Martin-esque singing voice. His voice was so good that Larry Crosby had wanted him to cut a record, although my father never pursued it. Dad was a sweet, fun-loving guy and was great with us kids. But he had a dark side, too. Dad, quote, was always a hit with the ladies. My mom used to tell us that when they were dating, she would dock him $500 every time she caught him dating another woman. When they married, they had enough saved from Dad's indiscretions to fully furnish their first apartment. Like many men who'd served, Don was traumatized by war and rarely spoke of his time in the army. He was also an alcoholic. At first, Sherry only saw him drinking at parties, of which her parents threw many. But through the years, she also saw him drinking alone in the middle of the night. He masked his problem well. Sherry remembers he was always fun to be around, and her siblings all adored him too. Sherry's mother, Marie Harmon, was a film actress in the 1940s. She came to LA with nothing but a dream and worked as a cigarette girl to make money for acting classes. This is such an old school thing. A cigarette yes. girl would like make the rounds at sports arenas selling individual cigarettes, just like the guys selling hot dogs and sodas would. Marie quit acting in the late 40s and opened a boutique. Quote, "In our family, my mother was the disciplinarian." Or, as my father used to say, "She likes to wear the pants in the family." Of course, my dad never liked that, and I was secretly convinced that this was a huge contributing factor to their split. We never had what you would call a
That was a funny.
Oh, welcome to the Dolls Podcast, real professional environment we got going. Get it together, AD. We never had what you would call a traditional mother-daughter relationship. I never went to the movies with my mom or did any of those mother-daughter things that other kids at my school seemed to do with theirs. My mom worked all the time, so us three kids tended to hang out all by ourselves. Despite the fact that I grew up in her house, I don't think my mother and I really got to know each other, at least not until much later, when we could relate to each other as grown women. As an adolescent, I was a mystery to my mother. And my mom was totally absorbed in her work. By 1972, Sherry's parents split. Don moved all the way out to Texas. Sherry said, quote, "My world literally crumbled. My father was the protector, the one who slept with a gun under the mattress, the one who would always ensure that we never came to any harm. With that gone, we felt scared, as if there was no one to protect us. The family just came apart at the seams." Sherry was deeply heartbroken, but soon her love for music filled that void.
As a teenager, Sherry started hanging out at the Sugar Shack in North Hollywood, a teen club where local youth dressed in glitter, satin, and platform boots, echoing the styles of the glam rockers they admired. But for Sherry, everything changed on September 8th of 1974, when she saw David Bowie perform at the Universal Amphitheater. Quote, "Then a silhouette appeared behind the sheer curtain, and everybody went insane because we knew that it was Bowie. He struck a pose and the audience lost their minds. He spread his legs, crouching down, and then, as my mouth hung open, the curtains burst apart, and David Bowie hopped onto the stage." Sniper in the brain, guns it takes in chain, incestuous and vain. All around me were Bowie's kids, Ziggy Stardust's bastard children, the kids who knew that David Bowie was the most beautiful, plastic, profound creature on the planet. Not the dumb kids at school who sneered that Bowie was a fag or too weird. We were screaming and singing and dancing out all of our rage, frustrations, and joys. When the song ended, the lights went out. And for a fraction of a second, before the place erupted into hysteria, it seemed like there was a moment of shocked silence. For that moment, I was somewhere else, somewhere profound. What I was witnessing tonight was nothing short of a revelation. As the last note rang out across the Universal Amphitheater, the lights began to come up, signaling that this really was the end of the show, and there would be no more encores. My whole body was vibrating with an energy that felt like the aftermath of being struck by lightning. I didn't want it to be over. I realized that the rest of these kids would be content now to go home, resume their lives, having let out a little of the pressure that had been building inside them. But not me. I knew that this would never be enough. I didn't want to go back to my lonely, ordinary reality. I wanted something more. That night, I was changed, altered in some profound way, and I knew I would never be the same again. Even when I was back at home, wiping away the remains of my makeup in the bathroom mirror, I couldn't see any physical manifestation of the change, but I could sense it. A glow inside of me that was growing with each passing moment. Was this what all those religious types were talking about when they said they had been born again? I guess that must be it. All I knew was that something was going to happen, and it was going to happen soon. I could sense it.
Can you imagine seeing David Bowie at the height of his fame as Ziggy Stardust, being right there just watching him in his prime? I could not. That would be like a religious experience.
Yes, I probably would have felt like she did.
No wonder Sherry was profoundly changed by this experience, especially kids in the 70s who grew up feeling like weirdos, feeling like outcasts. Bowie was like their idol because he was always changing and always embracing all these different facets of himself and just being unapologetic and weird.
Yeah,
that was a revelation back then.
Oh, it truly was. And for someone like Sherry, who always felt like she didn't fit in, I can only imagine what it was like to be part of this crowd of people who felt so close to her all of the sudden.
Yes.
And she also said in her book how she believes that this was what really made her think about becoming a musician, even though she kind of like stumbled into that. We'll talk about that in a second. But it is really interesting because she said all her career, she always wanted to be like David Bowie. He still is a huge role model for her. Sherry always felt like an outsider. Most of the people she hung around with were her sister's friends, and in school, the other students found her weird. But after seeing Bowie, she decided to embrace it. She cut her hair, started wearing heavy makeup, and often stayed out all night long, hanging around the clubs of LA. She was still a young teen, merely 14 years old, but she went wherever the music was, spending her nights in dark, crowded venues dancing.
I can relate to that, having most of your friends being your sister's friends. My sister and I are really close in age, so our parents effectively raised us as twins. We just hit a lot of our life milestones at the same time. And if you can imagine, I wasn't very cool growing up, so I just sort of inherited my sister's friends. And we're just friends with a lot of people in her grade.
That's sweet, though. On one hand, it kind of shields you from having to go out and make your own friends because you always have people hanging around. But then on the other hand, maybe because I was always alone, I don't have siblings, I was kind of forced to make friends because I was an only child. My parents were working all day long. And if I wouldn't have gone out and like actively made some friends, I would have probably spent most of my childhood by myself.
Yeah. So I relate to Sherry's experience of being the weird kid. Definitely.
Yeah.
Her favorite spot was the Sugar Shack. The Sugar Shack was tiny, but always packed. They didn't serve alcohol. Instead, they had a juice bar. But that didn't stop kids from drinking in the parking lot. It's never going to. They brought flasks filled with anything they could steal from their parents' liquor cabinets and stowed Quaaludes in their pockets. Teenage rebellion.
We've all been there.
I definitely had... Sorry, Mom. I definitely had the water bottle of vodka in the freezer.
Yes.
And I know my sister had one, too. And I feel like she might have gotten in trouble for mine every once in a while.
Have you ever, like, taken some of your parents' alcohol and then refilled it with water or something? Because I swear...
I didn't. I was smarter than that.
I did that. The good thing was my dad never had that alcohol. And then as he was moving out of this apartment, he was like moving in with his wife. And he was like, oh, what do I do about all of this alcohol? And I was like, well, there's none in there anymore practically. But I didn't dare to tell him. So I was like, don't you think it has gone bad? And he was like, I don't think it goes bad. I was like, maybe you should just get rid of it. Like, why carry all those just bottles over? And he dumped it. So I got away with it.
Yeah, there are still stunts that I pulled off 11, 12 years ago that my parents still have no idea about.
Yep. Hopefully that comes out when I'm like 60 or something.
Quote, it was at the Sugar Shack that I met a man who, for better or worse, would change my life forever. Sherry recalled the night she met Kim Fowley. Now, Kim Fowley had a long history before becoming manager to the Runaways. He considered himself kind of an impresario, talent scout, super manager. But, like, I think if the Sunset Strip were a reality show, Kim would be a professional friend of.
Yes.
He just kind of showed up everywhere.
Yes.
Once you know his name, it pops up all over the place. This is how Sherry described their first meeting. We're going to read the whole thing because it's really funny.
It truly is.
Quote, hello, said a voice to my right. It had a theatrical booming quality that startled me. I figured that it was maybe some random creep trying to make a move on me, so I turned to tell him to fuck off, but when I clamped my eyes on the figure next to me, I stopped myself. I immediately realized that this was no ordinary creep. For a start, he was not under 21, not by a long shot. The stranger was tall, real tall, and wearing the ugliest, tackiest, bright orange suit that I had ever laid my eyes on. The suit looked dirty and crumpled as if he'd woken up wearing it. He looked like some weird cross between a tangerine and Lurch from the Addams Family. Under the flickering club lights, it looked like he was wearing makeup, and he looked impossibly old to me, like somebody's insane cross-dressing grandfather. He was just so strange and tacky-looking that I started to laugh. He seemed unperturbed, though. He just kept staring at me, radiating this air of overblown importance. No, this guy was no ordinary creep. This guy was an extraordinary creep. I've seen you around, the tangerine Lurch said. You come here a lot, don't you? Yeah, I told him, turning back to my Coke to signal that the conversation was at an end. You gotta imagine all of this with, like, really loud music playing, too. So he goes, quote, I yes. like your look, the freak was saying. I like it a lot. You got balls, you know what I mean? The platinum blonde hair, the tight pants, the makeup, very cool. And you have this look in your eyes that says, I can beat the crap out of a truck driver. This made me laugh. I looked up to him again and said, what exactly do you want? He straightened up, took a deep breath, and announced, my name is Kim Fowley. I stared back at him. He was standing there, rocking back on his heels as if everything had just been explained because he'd uttered his name. I still had no idea who this creep was. After an awkward moment's silence, I said, well, good for you. Am I supposed to know you or something? Actually, the name did sound vaguely familiar. Not that I was about to give him the satisfaction of knowing that. I think I'd heard Rodney Bigenheimer mention it once or twice, but beyond some vague connection with the music industry, I really didn't have a clue who this guy was. I was getting intrigued, though. What exactly did he want? He smiled at me again and called for someone to join us over the thunderous sound of the club PAs. Joan! Joan, come over here! A girl walked over to us. She was around my age, really pretty, with brown and blonde streaked hair, dark eyes that seemed to radiate right out of her face. She walked over from the edge of the dance floor and stood next to Kim Fowley. She seemed real shy and was hiding her face behind that long, dark hair. I'd like you to meet Sherry, he said. I was about to ask him just how the hell he knew my name, but he cuts me off. Sherry, I'd like you to meet Joan Jett. Now I was impressed. Starstruck, almost. I had heard Joan Jett's name around the scene for what seemed like forever. Rodney Bigenheimer used to talk about her in the hushed, reverential tones he used for the most important faces on the scene. That girl is going places, he would say. Joan smiled and put her hand out toward me, saying hi. She seemed friendly enough, and her presence relaxed me a little. If Joan was involved with this Fowley guy, then he couldn't be all bad, could he? Tell me, Sherry, can you sing or play an instrument? Kim asked. I pursed my lips. This question had thrown me for a loop. I shrugged and said, I can't play an instrument. Why? Have you ever heard of the Runaways? Joan asked me. Sure, they're a new group, right? Joan nodded. Word of mouth about the Runaways had been spreading around the scene for the past few months. Nobody seemed to know too much about them, except that they were supposed to be the new hot thing. Everybody already had an opinion on them, yet nobody seemed to have seen them play yet. Now that I had admitted to knowing who the Runaways were, Kim went into his full salesman spiel.
They're only the hottest band of the decade, he informed me with a satisfied grin. The Runaways are a teenage all-girl rock and roll band. The Runaways are going to be the next female Beatles, the girl equivalent of Elvis or Bowie or Bo-fucking-diddly. I am the magician, the visionary that is going to make it happen. They are going to change the world. Joan here is the rhythm guitarist. The way he said it made me feel that he had given this speech many times before. Mm-hmm. Still, I couldn't help but be sucked in by his enthusiasm. What I couldn't figure out yet was why on earth he was giving this speech to me. So, what do you want with me? Read my lips, Kim told me. We like your look, yes? You can sing, can't you? When he said this, a few things flashed across my mind. The first was my music teacher, Miss Davenport, refusing to let me into the choir the first time I tried out, on the grounds that she thought my voice sucked. She didn't use those exact words, but she didn't have to. Her face said it all. The next thing I thought of was the school talent show, where I'd recently won first prize by lip-syncing to David Bowie. Marie and I had spent hours getting the costumes and the choreography perfect. When the song was over, the auditorium had gone wild. It was the craziest feeling, the most thrilling, goosebump-inducing sensation, when the final note rang out and the whole place erupted in cheers. Yeah, I can sing, I told him, trying to play it cool. I almost blurted out that my sister and I used to sing Dean Martin songs with my father at the Kiwanis Club, but I stopped myself, feeling like a hopeless square for even thinking about mentioning it. Instead, I said, I came in first at the school talent show singing David Bowie. I decided to leave out the lip-syncing part. David Bowie, huh? Kim said to me. Then he points a finger at my chest. If my instincts are correct, and one thing you will learn about me, Sherry, is that my instincts are always correct. By the time I'm done with you, you are going to be bigger than David Bowie. In fact, he said with a leer, you are going to have the likes of David Bowie licking those silver platform boots of yours. Joan started laughing at this, rolling her eyes. I guess she was well used to the strange way that Foley spoke, but I was still staring at him like he had two heads. He pulled a notebook and pen out of his pocket and asked me, "So, when are you free to audition?" Audition? Suddenly it hit me, with a twist of fear in the bottom of my gut. They were obviously trawling the under-21 clubs looking for a blonde girl in tight pants who looked like she could beat up a truck driver so she could sing in this crazy band they were putting together. And there I was. I placed a trembling hand on my glass of soda and tried my best to look nonchalant. Audition? I repeated dumbly. Yes, audition. What is a good time for you? Gee, Mr. Fowley, I stammered. I don't know. Any time, I guess. I watched as he thumbed through his appointment book. I still couldn't quite believe what was happening. Saturday at 2, he asked, fixing me with an expectant stare. I realized with a start that this was only 3 days away. Sure, perfect, I blurted out before I could change my mind. Excellent. He made some notes in that little book of his. Tell me, are you familiar with Suzy Quatro's music? Sure, I have all her albums, I said. Of course I had all of her albums. I was a music nut. My mom used to tell me that I wouldn't have room left for my bed if the vinyl collection in my bedroom kept growing. Great. Well, I want you to learn one of her songs. Anyone you like. You can sing that for your audition for the band. Kim Fowley was all business now. He was scribbling an address in his book. He ripped the page out and pressed it into my hand. With a sly smile, he started to turn away, but then stopped as if remembering something very important. Then he asked me, "Exactly how old are you, Sherry?" I sat up and assumed my most mature look. 15, I told him in my most confident voice. "I'm going to be 16 in a few months." With that, his huge, weird face creased into a smile. not an altogether nicer smile either. Good, he cooed. Very good. Something about the way that he said it made me imagine that he was about to say, young and fresh, just the way I like them. But thankfully he didn't. With that, he spun on his heels and walked away. I sat there watching him go, slightly shell-shocked. It was nice meeting you, Joan said before she herself went to leave. Then she half turned and yelled back, see you Saturday! And then she was gone, following Kim Fowley's hulking orange frame into the crowd.
Such a great story.
Yes.
The continual bringing up of the orange suit is just fantastic.
Yes.
When Saturday rolled around, Sherry was frightened. She'd been practicing Fever for hours every day since meeting Kim. Fever was originally recorded by Peggy Lee in 1956, but Sherry was determined to perform it just as cool as Suzy Quatro did. Sherry turned up at the address Kim gave her, and there she met the rest of the band. A dirty blonde named Sandy West, who played drums, a tall girl with black high-heel boots playing guitar, Lita Ford, and a thin blonde introducing herself as Carrie Chrome. She was the one writing the songs. Joan told Sherry that, if all went well, she'd be replacing a girl, Mickey Steele, who, according to Kim, lacked rock and roll authority. The girls suspected Kim wanted to fire Mickey because she was too old and not good-looking enough. When the band started playing, Sherry's hands went cold. They weren't only good, they were great. They sounded like a real band. When Sherry sang, Lita told her, they don't play show tunes like Fever. Sherry was terrified. This was the only song she'd practiced. But Joan offered to write a song for her, right there, on the spot. After about a half hour, Joan handed back a sheet with Cherry Bomb written on top, a pun on Sherry's name. Kim read the lyrics for Sherry so that she'd get a feel for the rhythm. Sherry had never sang or played with a band before. She was sure she sucked. And she was mad, mad at herself. Cherry Bomb only had 3 verses and a chorus. Not too hard to remember, yet she wasn't able to deliver it. She closed her eyes for a moment to channel her inner Bowie. When she was done, everyone left the garage they'd been playing in. Sherry stayed back and waited for 20 minutes, in which she was sure they were talking about how bad she was. Then they came back. Okay, dogs, Kim said, clapping his hands together. Looks like it's make or break time for our little Sherry Bomb. Let's go down the line. Joan? I liked it. Sandy? Great, you were great. Lita? Lita looked at me and snorted. She shrugged her shoulders. Yeah, she said finally, I guess. Carrie? Yeah. Well, Kim said with a theatrical sigh, welcome to the doghouse, Sherry. You have been given a chance to be part of history. Now don't fuck it up. They all just stood there. I was stunned, unable to speak. Joan was the first one to come over to me. She smiled. Congratulations, Joan Jett said. Welcome to the Runaways.
Because Sherry had replaced Mickey as the lead singer but couldn't play bass like Mickey, Kim strolled the under-21 clubs again, this time looking for a bassist. One night he met Jackie Fuchs. Jackie was different than the rest of the girls. As Sherry described her, she was a girly girl. She wasn't a great player, but she was good-looking, and Kim Fowley wanted to find someone better yesterday than today. He would go on and on about how much money rehearsing was costing him and how he wanted them to finally perform in public. Jackie was nice, and Sherry felt bad for not giving her a spot. But the others put their foot down. In their opinion, Jackie wasn't good enough, a bass player, and since Sherry had no idea how to play any instrument, she was overruled. However, a couple weeks later, Kim had some news. Apparently, Jackie had formed her own all-girls rock band, and Kim was so impressed by her determination that he asked her to come back. And so Jackie became the 5th runaway. Only her last name needed to be changed, and so Jackie Fox was born. I found that to be really interesting because Fuchs is the German word for fox. So they didn't really change the name. I couldn't find out whether she had German ancestors, but I can tell you that about her name. They started practicing daily, and from the beginning there were issues. Kim was often loud and aggressive and fought with everyone. One time, just weeks into Sherry joining the band, it got so bad that Sandy threw her over a car in a fight. They always made up, but Kim's constant screaming, shouting, and watching the girls every step really didn't help. He called them dog shit and dog puke or dog piss. Overall, he treated them badly. But they had a dream, and so they stuck around trusting that Kim had their best interests at heart. He made the girls feel like they needed him, as if they were just the lucky ones he'd pulled from nowhere and turned into stars. The Runaways started as his idea, but the energy they brought, songs about boys, rebellion, and the late nights, turned them into a real band fast. Kim, afraid they'd realize they were the power behind the music, clung tightly to control. One day he announced a visit from Mercury Records executive Danny Rosenkrantz. Legend said Hendrix had once told Danny that women could rule rock, and maybe this was that moment. Sherry was nervous. This was Danny's second look at the band after a past rejection, and it felt like everything was riding on this. They launched into Cherry Bomb, all fire and fury. When the last note hit, the room fell silent until Danny finally smiled and made his offer. Quote, "Nobody knew what to say. A record? It felt like I had barely been in the band for 2 minutes, and now we had a deal with Mercury Records. I felt lightheaded, euphoric. It was left to Lita to sum up the mood in the room when she said, 'Fuck yeah, Mr. Rosenkrantz, we want to make a record.'"
But Sherry hadn't even told her mom she joined a band yet. Her mother had met a man named Wolfgang, and they'd taken off for Indonesia weeks before. She left her children to take care of themselves. When they came back, Sherry told her mom she was recording an album. "That's really great," she said, "but Wolfgang and I have some wonderful news for you too." And news they had! Her mother decided to marry Wolfgang and move to Indonesia permanently. Sherry, Marie, and Donnie couldn't believe it. Sherry didn't want to leave LA. Her career was about to take off, and she finally felt like she belonged somewhere. Marie was set on staying wherever Sherry was. Even if Sherry wanted to leave, she couldn't have. Because all the girls were underage, they needed a parent or guardian to sign the recording contract. You'd think this wouldn't have applied to Sherry, but since her mom was in Indonesia at the time, she brought Sandra to sign it. She was 8 years older than Sherry, a legal adult. Sandra read the paperwork and was horrified at what she found. Sherry remembered, quote, "She pulled me aside and told me that the contract put Kim in charge of all of the money, and that was not a good idea. And she thought that Kim was a real snake. I told her to leave it alone. If you ruin this for me, I'll never forgive you. Just sign the paper and don't make waves. I'll never get an opportunity like this again." When Kim heard of the possible move, he went to the Currys' house to tell her mother that he legally owned her daughter. Her mother's jaw dropped, but there was nothing she could do. Sherry and Marie moved into their aunt's house, sharing a cramped room, while Donnie went to live with their mom in Indonesia. It would be 2 whole years before they'd see each other again. Recording the Runaways' debut album was pretty much like every other day with Kim. They played, he screamed at them, then played some more, he screamed some more, until they called it quits for the day. After a couple weeks, the album was finished. They'd been playing gigs around LA already, and Kim had done a phenomenal job at promoting them. He just told everyone that they were the next big thing, and people believed him. So when the Runaways played their final show before their album release, the venue was fully booked. People stood outside waiting for them to sign autographs. Without an album to sign yet, and to Sherry, everything just seemed so surreal. She herself had a surprise for the night. The girls' costumes were shimmering lamé overalls, which Kim believed exuded rock and roll authority. However, a few days prior, Sherry saw a white corset in a lingerie shop and decided to buy it. That night on stage, while Joan was singing You Drive Me Wild, Sherry ran backstage to change. You know when you're close, you really turn me on. As the first notes of Cherry Bomb filled the room, Sherry stepped out in her white corset and underwear. Quote, fans crawled over each other to get to the stage, only to be thrown back by security. One guy grabbed at my leg, ripping my stocking. Seeing this, Joan walked over and, without missing a beat, casually kicked him in the head. I saw Jackie reaching over to touch the hand of someone in the audience, and she is nearly dragged off stage. The whole place was in a state of total fucking pandemonium. On the last beat of the song, I looked up to the heavens, punching my hand to the sky. I froze. There was a heart-stopping moment of silence before the crowd went berserk, and I knew that from this moment on, my performances with The Runaways would never be the same.
Their debut album, simply titled The Runaways, hit shelves in March of 1976 through Mercury Records and made a modest initial splash, charting at number 188 on the Cashbox Top Album chart. But chart placement was almost besides the point. The shock wave were felt elsewhere among kids turning into late-night FM stations, in radio stores where the cover image of five teenage girls dressed like glam rock gunslingers caused double takes, and in the press where critics seemed both impressed and confused by what exactly they were witnessing. The reviews were mostly favorable, surprisingly so. Some critics didn't know what to do with teenage girls shouting, "Hello world, I'm your wild girl," over slashing guitars. But others recognized something real under the glitter and sneers. A genuine rock band, not a novelty act. The standout track, Cherry Bomb, exploded across underground radio and college stations, like it had been waiting in a powder keg, aching for a match. Sales eventually reached 70,000 units. Not astronomical, but solid enough to prove they weren't just riding on hype. For girls barely old enough to vote, or in some cases not old enough to drive, that was no small feat. To support the album, The Runaways hit the road, opening for heavyweights like Cheap Trick, Talking Heads, Van Halen, and Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
They also opened for Rush. Just going off memory, the guys in Rush were, like, screwing around and, like, throwing papers on the stage while they were performing, and Cherry slipped on one and fell into the orchestra pit.
Oh, wow.
So she's had beef with Rush for forever for that.
The pairing of The Runaways with these bands, especially the hard rock and punk ones, only made their sets more electric. They were out to prove they could go toe-to-toe with anyone. And live, they were a force. Each girl crafted her own stage persona around her musical hero. Sherry channeled David Bowie in a corset and fishnets, all icy glam and space-age sexuality. Joan Jett snarled like Suzy Quatro, with a guitar slung low. Lita Ford wielded her axe like warrior, part Jeff Beck, part Ritchie Blackmore, shredding with fury. Sandy West behind the drums kept the heart beating, a miniature Roger Taylor with power to spare. And Jackie Fox, cool and calculated, gave off Gene Simmons energy with the studio's menacing poise. But backstage, the cracks were starting to show. Being teenagers thrown into the lion's den of the rock and roll world, under Kim's manipulation, media scrutiny, and the wild unpredictability, life on tour was taking a toll. There were fights, frustrations, and doubts, yet on stage they held the line. One thing that seemed to keep them together was their communal hate of Kim Fowley. Not only would he always put them in cramped hotel rooms together, be in charge of their money and not pay them, wouldn't let them eat before shows, he also genuinely creeped them out. There's one chapter in the book where Sherry recalls how Kim had sex right in front of the whole band to teach them how to fuck. They wanted to leave, but he wouldn't let them. There are so many more of these stories, but because he literally owned the girls by contract, there wasn't much they could do. Soon, Sherry turned to drugs to cope. It started with alcohol, but soon she turned to pills and cocaine. The endless touring, fighting, and performance took a toll on her. And yet she was living a double life. Away from the spotlight, she was still a regular 15-year-old sharing a room with her twin sister in her aunt's home.
Soon, the Runaways were put back in the studio. This time around, it was more difficult. Tensions were high not only between the girls and Kim, but inside the band. Lita felt like the entire focus was on Sherry, which she hated, so she constantly criticized her singing. Sherry's throat was already hurting from all the yelling, so her singing got progressively worse. The girls fought over who would play or sing what, arrangements, and everything else. They were teenage girls, a catty bunch to begin with. And Kim really didn't help. Determined to make them bigger stars than David Bowie, he sold them out to the press, making up all kinds of headlines and rumors. One day at practice, someone brought in an issue of Crawdaddy magazine. Sherry read a line that tore her apart. Quote, "There was a section of the piece where the journalist had asked Kim what it was like working with me. Kim's response? Handling Sherry Curry's ego is like having a dog urinate in your face. A lump forming in my throat, I read on. The best thing that could happen to this band, Kim said, would be if Sherry hung herself from a shower rod and put herself in the tradition of Marilyn Monroe." Sherry stormed out of rehearsals that day. She couldn't take it anymore.
Can you imagine being so young, being famous, being everywhere, and then your manager talking like that about you?
Is just like, your manager is like constantly tormenting you. This is like psychological torture at this point.
There's like a controversy because we're going to get a little bit into that later, but Sherry and Joan mostly stayed and still stay on Kim Fowley's side. Like, they still are quite loyal to him. And I have to say, I don't think if he wouldn't have done that, they would have ever been as popular as they were. Like, what he was doing definitely worked. It was a good marketing campaign.
Yeah, what he was doing worked on the publicity side.
Yes, it worked fantastic.
But what he was doing behind the scenes was
gruesome.
Just disgusting. Yes.
And to treat, like, these were not even minors. Like, at 15, you're still a kid. You're not 17 or 18, which is still so young, but like 15, it's so wild to me that things like these just like flew by back then.
Soon after this, Sherry discovered she was pregnant. She'd been feeling sick for weeks. The thought of becoming a mother terrified her. She was only about 16. She decided to have an abortion. Her father, sister, and aunt all visited her in the hospital. They were all supportive. But Sherry was heartbroken. She knew something needed to change. When the Runaways finished their second album, Queens of Noise, the wild rock star life started up once again. Released in 1977, it saw them find greater success, especially in Japan. The band went on another US tour, this time traveling by air and playing huge venues. Cheap Trick and Tom Petty opened for them, and they heard their own music wherever they went. Quote, "No sooner had we wrapped up the second US tour than it seemed we were about to leave on our first Japanese tour. The Runaways embarking on their first Japanese tour was the highlight of my time in the band. Unlike in America, where the press and a large section of the general public could never get over our ages or shake off the suspicion that somehow the Runaways were some kind of monkeys-type band overseen by Kim Fowley, people really got us in Japan." There, tensions within the Runaways were nearing a boiling point. Kim had promised the band Japan would be their big moment, and he wasn't wrong. But behind the scenes, things were going anything but smoothly. Sherry knew the stakes were high going in. Jackie Fox had become a major source of strain within the group. Her bass playing just wasn't keeping up with the rest of the band anymore, and it was becoming more noticeable on stage and in the studio. On top of that, her aloof attitude made her hard to connect with. While others went out to blow off steam, Jackie stayed buried in books or was complaining about the set list, the schedule, the money, Kim, the partying, the drugs, everything. Her constant whining grated on everyone, and Sherry, usually patient, found Jackie's voice unbearable. The band dynamic had started to feel like a wild, unruly girls' school trip with one painfully strict chaperone. Then, an article in a Japanese music magazine almost destroyed it all. Kim had arranged for the photographer to only feature Sherry, posing in provocative shots taken back at her aunt's house. Sherry already had her suspicions about Kim's manipulative tactics, but even she was shocked to see that the rest of the band was completely excluded from this feature. Lita was livid when she saw the cover, her eyes nearly bulging out of her head. The rest of the girls had no idea there'd even been a solo shoot, and the fact that they'd been left out entirely felt like a slap in the face. Things got worse when they flipped through their official tour booklet. Almost every photo was of Sherry. And then came the merch. T-shirts emblazoned with a graphic of Sherry's white corset, making it clear who the star attraction was supposed to be. A heavy cloud of resentment settled over the group. What was meant to be their triumphant moment started to feel more like a cruel power play by Kim, and it deepened the rift between Sherry and the rest of the band.
Quote, "The Japanese tour lasted for a couple of months. Coming to Japan was our first experience of being treated like real superstars. It was like Beatlemania, runaway mania, really. We were huge on the radio over there and had already attracted a devoted and fanatical fan base. Everywhere we went, people stopped to give us beautiful gifts, asked for autographs and posed for pictures. Our Japanese label spared no expense, and we stayed in only the grandest and most luxurious hotels. It was the only tour we had ever done in which we didn't have to share rooms. Not only that, but the rooms that we had were incredibly extravagant. While they were in Japan, many of their performances were recorded and, with some overdubbing, later released as an album titled Life in Japan."
Tokyo, good evening. Please welcome from Hollywood, California, the Queens of Noise, the Runaways!
Felt like they finally lived the rock star life they wanted, but at the same time, everything was starting to fall apart. It all started with Jackie. While it's easy to believe that the girls were making good money back then, this was far from the truth. Kim paid them little to nothing, and so when Jackie's bass, that she loved so dearly, and for which her parents had taken out a loan, fell and the head snapped off, she was heartbroken. And mad. She accused the roadies, Sherry, and practically everyone to be responsible for this before storming upstairs into her room. Sherry went after her, and when she finally opened the door, Jackie was standing there with a chunk of broken glass in her hand, her arm covered in blood. She was hacking at her arm, and when Sherry tried to stop her, she got some cuts too. Quote, "Jackie was hysterical, and by the time I'd thrown the glass to the floor, she'd collapsed on the bed, sobbing uncontrollably. I had never seen anybody in such a state. As I tried to comfort her and stop the bleeding with a bath towel, I realized that this wasn't just about her bass anymore. The bass had been the last straw. But finally, all of the bullshit that we had put up with Kim's abuse, the roadie's indifference, the internal pressure, the arguments, the mismanagement of our money, all of it had climaxed into this. Jackie just lay there, bloody, and barely aware that I was even in the room. The following morning at breakfast, after a sleepless night, we were all informed that Jackie Fox had already left Japan. And not only that, she had left the Runaways. Little did I know that the final show we played in Japan would be my last as a member of the Runaways. Back in LA, Sherry spent the following weeks in a haze of drugs and exhaustion. It was just all too much, but there was no time to rest. As they touched US grounds again, Kim had already found a new bass player, a girl named Vicky Blue. She was a better bass player than Jackie, but it wasn't the same playing with her. As dysfunctional of a family the Runaways were, they, after all, still were a family. A couple weeks later, at a photo shoot, it all fell apart. Sherry had taken her sister Marie's car and promised her to be back home by 6:30. Marie had started taking acting classes and worked hard to pay for them, so missing one wasn't an option. When Sherry arrived to the shoot, no one besides the photographer was there yet. After a while, Sandy came in, then Vicky and Joan, and finally Lita. Sherry had told the photographer early on that she needed to leave by 6:30, but as the clock turned 5:30, they still had 3 outfit changes left. At around 6, Sherry reminded everyone again that she had to leave, and this time Lita snapped. The two got in a huge fight. When Sherry ran into the back room, Lita broke down the door to follow her. For a moment, the two stood in front of each other. Then Sherry took her things and left. Quote, I knew then, as I got into Marie's car and took off with a screech of brakes, that the runaways for me were over. When she opened the door to her aunt's house, she could hear her talking on the phone. It was Kim. Quote, It's over, Kim, I said. I can't take it anymore. I'm leaving the band. Instead of the avalanche of abuse I was expecting Kim to lay on me, he said, without missing a beat, No problem, Sherry. To be honest, I'm surprised the band lasted this long. I have another project lined up for you, a solo album. You'll do your album, and if they decide to stay on, they can do an album of their own. Then everybody's happy, yes? So I still have a record deal? Yes, we'll talk tomorrow.
You have to wonder if this was Kim's plan the entire time, pitting all these girls against each other to effectively weed out the last woman standing and then hand her a solo career. It's so messed up.
Yeah.
All of the adults surrounding them were implicit on pitting everyone against each other.
Yes. It is so insane. I didn't put this in the script, but I feel like it is important to talk about. Jackie has since come out, like a couple of years ago, and said that Kim raped her, and that was also a reason why she left the band. And she said that Joan and Sherry were there and no one helped her. Sherry and Joan deny this. They stay by Kim. They say they have no idea if something like that happened, but they definitely weren't complicit in it. But I don't know. I just want to say I don't think it is the wildest idea that something like this might have happened, just judging by the way that Kim was treating everyone and also judging by the hostile environment he built for them. Like, down to the roadies, down to absolutely everyone working with them, treated them like absolute shit. And it is so unbelievable to me that, like, to think about about the pressure that these girls were under. It is quite the surprise that the band worked for 2 years.
Beauty's Only Skin Deep, Sherry's first solo album, was released in 1978.
I was born beautiful 18 years ago. Got the super silver smile. My hair, it shines like gold. No one on earth has ever said to me, I read between the lines, you have a beautiful mind. Beauty's only skin deep, it doesn't mean I'm cold. Beauty's only skin deep, I need a hand to hold.
Kim, of course, brought her to Japan to promote it. As always, he had some promotional magic up his sleeve. He broke the news to the media that Sherry was a twin. People couldn't believe that there was another Sherry Curry. So Kim decided that the two should record and perform a song called Love at First Sight together. Beauty's Only Skin Deep failed to make major success, but Sherry didn't really care. She was burnt out. The best thing that came from the record was that Kim Fowley finally let her go. She was 17 now, had quit the Runaways, and already released a solo record, and now she wanted to have some fun. She wrote in her memoir how she was high from the moment she woke up, from the moment she went to bed. She went out partying, where she would be recognized by fans telling her how much they loved the Runaways. And Sherry took more drugs in hopes to forget that. We would like to issue a trigger warning here. The next part details violence and sexual assault, so please skip ahead 3 minutes. I think that's a safe amount to skip ahead. If this topic is sensitive to you, please stay safe and take care of yourselves, dear listeners. This is a harrowing read. One night, Sherry's partying put her in a very dangerous situation. James Lloyd White, a stranger with a slick smile and unsettling eyes, pulled up in a limo in front of Sherry and convinced her to join him under the guise of a party, drugs, and familiar connection. He convinced her they'd met before. What began as cautious curiosity quickly turned to fear as James locked the car doors behind her and drove past every turnoff, his charm giving way to threats and violence. He took Sherry to a remote, decaying house. She was held against her will and subject to terrifying abuse. She truly thought she was going to die. In a moment of desperation, she found a butter knife and fought back. Though it didn't stop James, it sparked hope for her survival. She found a way to emotionally trick him, making him believe she'd go away with him. She just wanted to stop by the club to get her things. She'd left her purse there. That's how her friends knew she was in trouble. That bought her just enough time to run away. Remarkably, she found a friend who alerted the police. James was arrested the next day. Quote, "He pleaded to sodomy by force and got 1 year in county," Sherry later recalled. "They dropped the kidnapping, the beating, everything, all the sexual assault. I think he's dead today, to be honest, or changed his name." After the kidnapping, Sherry sought therapy. She eventually became a counselor herself, intent on leaving the scene behind. She tried to figure out what she wanted to do with her life.
This story is just so insane. And the fact that he ended up only getting a year in jail is astonishing to me. Because she was a minor. And like, I have no idea what kind of lawyer he had or how this happened. Because I would imagine that for something like this, you would go to jail for like 10 years or so. This is like a severe crime. And usually with people like that, they are prone to doing something like that again. So you get locked up longer.
And she was famous. Yes. You'd think this would be a really high-profile thing, but it kind of wasn't.
Because she kind of, like, she stopped being with the runaways, and people didn't care anymore. It was kind of sad, to be honest. But what I found really interesting is that she said, in hindsight, she only got into the car because she was such a people pleaser back then, and he convinced her that they knew each other, and so she was like, it's rude if I don't get in that car. And she said that this dynamic also ruled a lot of her time with Kim Fowley. She just wanted to do what people told her. She didn't want it to make anyone angry or mad.
It wound up being really lucky that she left her purse behind, too.
Yes, she got so, so lucky because he had, like, trash bags. He had everything, probably planning to kill her. And she just outsmarted him and got away. Because police, even if like an investigation would have been started, it would have probably taken days. And by then it would have been too late. So she really saved herself. That is such an impressive story to me. In 1980, Sherry made her acting debut, starring alongside Jodie Foster in Foxes. She really enjoyed working on set, and her mother even came to visit her and help her improve her acting. Her performance was met with strong reviews, a fresh and promising new voice capturing attention. That same decade, she appeared in a handful of films, including Parasite, Wavelength, Twilight Zone the movie, The Rosebud Beach Hotel, where she shared the screen with her sister Marie, and Rich Girl. Sherry also made guest appearances on popular TV series, such as Matlock and Murder, She Wrote, becoming a steady member of the entertainment world. In 1984, Sherry was cast as Brenda in Savage Streets, though she was eventually replaced by Linda Blair. That same year held a bittersweet note. She was cast as the lead singer of a fictional band, The Does, in This Is Spinal Tap, but her scenes were cut from the final film. Her career faced another setback in 1985 when she was considered for a role in Explorers, but her ongoing battle with drug dependency kept her from even attending the meeting. The 1980s were also a time of creative collaboration with Marie. The sisters performed together on television shows like Sha Na Na, The Mike Douglas Show, and The Merv Griffin Show. Their musical bond deepened as they wrote and produced songs for the Rosebud Beach Hotel soundtrack and acted and sang side by side in the film itself. In 1991, they paid tribute to Paula Pierce of the Pandoras in a heartfelt concert where the remaining Pandoras joined the Currys for the final song.
On May 12, 1990, Sherry married actor Robert Hayes. The couple divorced in 1997, but they co-parented their son Jake, who grew up to be a musician too. The 90s brought an initial Runaways resurgence. There was another in 2011 with the movie. In 1994, Sherry joined a Runaways reunion lineup with Jackie Fox and Sandy West. Marie joined in too to help bring the spirit of the band back to life. In 1998, the Curry sisters held a concert at the Golden Apple supporting a re-release of Messin' with the Boys, Sherry's second solo album, which originally came out in 1980. Sandy West joined them on stage to play some more of the Runaways' hits. The Young and Wild compilation was released in 1998, and the 80s collection released in 2000. Throughout the 2000s, Sherry embraced a new creative facet. She learned how to carve with a chainsaw, using her skill to shape raw wood into art. I don't know why that makes so much sense for Sherry, but it just does. She opened her own gallery in Chatsworth, California in 2005 and literally carved out a new identity in the art world. She's competed in and won awards at 3 World Chainsaw Art Competitions, her sharp vision and bold style earning her acclaim. That same year, the Runaways were set to play again when Sherry got a devastating phone call. Sandy West had been diagnosed with small cell lung cancer. She passed away on October 21st, 2006, at just 47 years old. Sandy was always the one putting together the Runaways reunions, dreaming of playing with the full band again, but she didn't get the chance to see that wish come true. Sherry carved a statue of a mermaid playing guitar in her honor. It took 2 months to complete, but it felt like Sandy was right there with her the whole time. Sherry was present at the unveiling of the statue. Quote, "That morning, Joan wept because she couldn't attend, as she sat in her hotel room thousands of miles away on tour. So I said a few words on her behalf. It was on that day that I finally felt at peace with it all. I knew that Sandy was smiling down on me and all who loved her. She was with us and would remain with Joan and me throughout this journey, this new adventure of our lives. We have her blessing. She is here. And now the adventure begins again." To honor Sandy, a tribute concert was held on December 9th in LA. Sherry and the Sandy West Band performed with fellow all-girl rock bands The Bangles and The Donnas to honor Sandy's memory. Carmine and Vinnie Appice played as well.
Even years later, Sherry continued to record and collaborate. In 2013, she was a guest vocalist on Shameless's album Beautiful Disaster and released singles with her former bandmate Lita Ford and with Glenn Danzig. I was so happy to hear that Lita and Sherry made up, because throughout this entire book, the two really can't stand each other. They constantly get into fights. Lita really felt overshadowed by Sherry, which I can understand, but Lita ended up having such a great career of her own, so that is really great. But I love that they could both kind of like move past the "we were teenage girls," whatever, and now they're friends. I feel like that's really, really powerful.
You think they butt heads so much because their personalities were pretty similar and they just kind of grated on each other in that way?
I read an interview with Lita where she said she was just pissed off because she obviously was a much better musician. I don't think there's any doubt in that. Lita Ford is a great guitar player, and Sherry really just kind of like started and was in front of the band. Like, she was leading this when technically she really wasn't good. And they even voted. I mean, they kind of ended up getting Jackie Fox removed also because she wasn't good enough, when in reality, Sherry probably lacked the quality. I don't want to say the quality, but like, she wasn't a great musician either back then. She just didn't have any practice yet. And I can understand how someone like Lita, who is generally a technically great player, would get pissed off by that. But I also think it's just, Man, teenagehood is so hard. Mm-hmm. I honestly think that's such a big part of it. Because even now, all of them looking back, they're like, this was so stupid, but we butt heads here and there. And I can remember when I was a teenager, you just feel everything so mm-hmm. deeply. Everything is so much worse than when you're an adult. So, I don't know. I'm just glad that they made up.
We need somebody... If any of our listeners make, like, TikTok edits, we need to edit Sherry Curry and Lita Ford to Girl So Confusing. I don't know if you like me. Sometimes I think you might hate me.
October of that year brought a triumphant moment. Sherry won the Rock Legend Award at the Malibu Music Awards, presented by none other than Lita Ford. Their reunion on stage marked the first time in 37 years that they had played together, a powerful moment of reconciliation and celebration. 2015 was a busy year. Sherry released Reverie, an album rich with collaboration, including Lita Ford, her son Jake, and even Kim Fowley. In the dark we come alive, the shadows hold the key to unlock the door. I don't want to stay awake. I need to close my eyes to wake on the other side. That November, she toured the UK and while there recorded Midnight Music in London, a live album featuring a special appearance by Suzy Quatro. The following year, Sherry expanded her touring to Australia and New Zealand, reaching fans across continents. In 2019, Sherry teamed up with Bree Darling of the all-female 70s rock band Fanny for a new album titled The Motivator. The record featured covers of T-Rex, The Rolling Stones, John Lennon, and more, alongside some original songs. It charted on Billboard's Heat Seekers list and received acclaim for its unapologetically rock and roll sound. Unfortunately, and this is quite disappointing to us, in recent years, Sherry has publicly aligned herself with conservative politics and expressed support for Donald Trump. She has been vocal in her criticism of the Democratic Party, accusing it of mishandling various issues, including crime and inflation. In a social media post, she stated, "It used to be punk, R&R, to vote Democrat. I fell for it. But when your party demands you live in fear, no more. The Democrat Party can kiss my ass." She also made statements regarding transgender topics that have sparked controversy, to say the least. In a 2024 interview, she used a photo of herself, dressed as David Bowie in the 1970s, to comment on gender identity, suggesting that her own experience of wanting to be male was a phase and implying that similar feelings in minors should be treated as such. Additionally, she appeared on a podcast discussing gender identity politics, where she expressed concerns about the impact of what she referred to as the, quote, radical trans agenda on women and children. "We want to make clear that these are not the values we stand by. It's disappointing and heartbreaking to hear her be so vocal about these things, and we don't support any of her recent remarks."
Listen, you are allowed to critique the American Democratic Party. Absolutely.
Yes.
But the thing that gets me is, like, the toting these conspiracies about, like, trans people and the whole think of the children thing.
Yes.
Because Sherry and the Runaways came up in glam rock, which celebrates all the, quote, freaks of the world. The guys who wear lipstick, the girls who kiss other girls, and the people who wake up saying, you know, I feel the male side of me speaks to me more today, and then maybe a little while down the line, you know, I'm just more in touch with my feminine side, and maybe both ends of the gender spectrum don't quite speak to them. To be toting things like that, it means that Sherry was either just saying this stuff to go against the grain and didn't really believe that, you know, you should just be allowed to be a freak in the world. Or that, you know, she's easily swayed, and I don't know which is worse.
It breaks my heart.
It's the same thing with Alice Cooper, you know? Alice Cooper's been saying stuff like this as well. Which is, again, strange to me, because he was saying all this real progressive stuff about gender identity in the 70s. And then David Bowie, towards the end of his life, was saying really progressive stuff on the topic. I like to think Mark Bolan would have been in this vein as well. Yeah. Don't meet your idols, man.
No. There's this saying, I don't know how exactly it goes, but basically that for some people, especially rock stars like that, it's good that they died back then and that they can't weigh in on these kind of topics because it would ruin so much. And we've seen this so much in recent years. Like, do you remember how Eric Clapton went berserk over COVID? All of these things.
How could I forget?
It's so unhinged to me, honestly. It breaks my heart because in the book, Sherry speaks about how as a child, she felt like she didn't fit in. And to be so outspoken about this now is just so strange. It doesn't make any sense.
Like, it's disappointing. It's going against the thing that you came up on.
And it's such a slap in the face to the people who supported you, because this is kind of like your community. A lot of the people listening to The Runaways back then and now are queer people. And so to just be so outspoken against them is just so... it's so heartbreaking and disappointing.
Still like the music, though. Being a classic rock fan is just an endless exercise in separating the art from the artist. Endless.
Yes. Yes. All day, every day.
Today, Sherry Curry continues to perform, create, and inspire. That's one thing that I like about her, is that she's still performing in her 70s. You, especially as a woman, you are never too old to be doing what you love. Her life, from a surf-loving valley girl to the face of teenage rebellion to an actress, survivor, author, and artist marked by resilience and resolution. She's been sober for decades, rebuilt her relationships with her family, and remains proud of her son Jake. Sherry's legacy is more than just Cherry Bomb. Her legacy should be about a girl who faced the chaos of the spotlight too young, survived through addiction and loss, and came out the other side stronger, carving her own place in rock history. One story, one sculpture, and one scream at a time. That's what the Dolls Pod would like to elevate about Sherry.
In 2010, Joan Jett wrote a foreword to Sherry's book, perfectly capturing her. Quote, "So to conclude, Sherry Curry, mother, uniquely devoted ex-wife, musician, versatile visual artist, is really so talented. I still can't believe Sherry carves wood with a chainsaw and is so good at it. But what truly amazes me is what a fine, honest, introspective author she is, with an incredible tale about an incredible life and a fascinating personal odyssey as she lived it."
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s. We hope you enjoyed our journey through the life of the brave and trailblazing Sherry Curry.
Before we fully log off today, we would like to give you a little heads up that we are taking 3 weeks between this episode and the next episode, not two like usually.
I know that sounds scary, but it's literally just an extra week.
Yes, and we will be back with something really special. We decided to do a really special little mini-series for the end of this season, so just give us an extra week. You will not regret it.
What did we say before we turned on the mics? Like, we're preparing episodes, and like, Emma is preparing to have a child. So this is our grace week. We're allowed.
Yes. As always, we're Emma.
And Abby.
Your hosts, and we're thrilled to have you with us on this groovy adventure. Remember, the spirit of these trailblazing ladies lives on in each one of us, inspiring us to embrace our individuality, creativity, and passion for change.
If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe to, rate, and review the show on your favorite streaming platform. Your feedback means the world to us, and it helps others discover the magic of these legendary dolls.
As always, we'd like to thank special friend of the show, Michael Teggio, for the wonderful intro song. Until the next time, keep the music loud, the fashion groovy, and the spirit of the 60s and 70s alive in your hearts.
Peace,
love,
and rock and roll.